Civil rights activists and others plan commemorations starting today for the 40th anniversary of the March on Washington. Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial back in 1963. In the first of a three-part series, NPR's Juan Williams reports on how that march came to be.
In the last 40 years, the March on Washington has taken on a golden halo in the nation's memory. It's now the prime example of Americans peacefully petitioning their government for change. But that's not the whole story. Top civil rights groups were divided by the march. Young black militants predicted it would be nothing but a picnic at the Lincoln Memorial. Older black leaders thought it might end in violence. On the night before the march, the speaker system was sabotaged. Meanwhile, the Kennedy White House and the Congress opposed it, fearing riots. Reverend Walter Fontroy represented Martin Luther King Jr.'s Southern Christian Leadership Conference in early meetings with the Justice Department.
I'll never forget the first meeting with Bobby Kennedy and Burke Marshall on the subject when we decided we've got to go. They said, you really can't do this. It's going to be an embarrassment. They're going to tear the city up. Not your people, but they'll be provocateurs. Don't do it.
Got my long government letters, my time to go. When I got to the army, found the same old Jim Crow, Uncle Sam says.
The idea for a march on Washington first came from labor leader and civil rights activist A. Philip Randolph in 1941. Here's his account of a meeting he held with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to discuss the possibility of a massive civil rights march on Washington.
He said, Phil Randolph, we can't have 100,000 Negroes marching on Washington. If anything such as that were to occur, you wouldn't be able to manage them. We might have bloodshed and death. He said, now let us get on to business here and find out what can be done.
In order to get Randolph to call off the march, President Roosevelt agreed to allow blacks to work in factories supplying America's military. 20 years later, Randolph was still active in civil rights when the idea of the march was revived. 1963 was the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. But more importantly, the fight for racial equality in the South was stalled. King was facing police dogs and fire hoses as he tried to integrate stores and restaurants in Birmingham, Alabama. As the Birmingham demonstrations came to a close in April, King was being urged to stage a month-long march from the Deep South all the way to Washington. Andrew Young was one of King's top aides.
The young people, they were literally talking about getting out on Highway 11 as they got out of jail in Birmingham, just starting walking up the highway till they got to Washington. And we said, well, how are you going to feed people? He said, if we just start walking in faith, we'll find enough to eat on the way there. Even Dr. King, I think, felt that that was a little too romantic.
King decided to support the one-day march on Washington. When it was announced that he was joining the march, other civil rights leaders felt they had to be there. The White House also changed its mind and decided to support the march. They wanted to gain some control over it. In addition, Kennedy encouraged white organizations to become involved, including the United Auto Workers, Jewish groups, and the Catholic Church. He wanted to make sure it would not be an all-black affair. The administration also arranged to place Army intelligence and FBI agents inside the march to keep an eye on the crowd. Joe Califano was Kennedy's general counsel to the Army.
We took a lot of actions. We closed the liquor stores. We insisted that the marches come in and out on the same day, that they not spend the night in Washington. And we also put troops on alert. We actually moved some troops to Fort Myer, which is right next to Washington.
But still, the White House was very concerned about a speech to be given by John Lewis, the leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, better known as SNCC. On the day before the march, civil rights leaders released copies of their speeches to the press and the White House. Lewis's speech called for civil rights activists to march through the South, like the Union Army's General Sherman, the man who burned down Atlanta. The administration sent a message to Lewis demanding that he tone down his speech. At first, Lewis wouldn't change a word. Then, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, Lewis says he got a personal request he couldn't refuse.
And it was A. Philip Randolph who appealed to me and said, John, we come so far together, let's stay together. And for the second unity, can we delete the reference to Sherman? And you couldn't say no to A. Philip Randolph.
Cortland Cox, another SNCC activist, was with Lewis.
We got an old portable typewriter, and we went behind the Lincoln Memorial, and we made the changes to the speech. Needless to say, I was denounced as an Uncle Tom and a traitor by the SNCC people for giving in to the Kennedy administration.
When Lewis finally gave the address, there were Kennedy administration officials positioned to pull the electrical connection on the speaker system if he began to use inflammatory rhetoric.
We must get in this revolution and complete the revolution. For in the Delta of Mississippi, in Southwest Georgia, in the Black Belt of Alabama, in Harlem, in Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, and all over this nation, the black masses on the march for joy and freedom.
There had been arguments among civil rights leaders about who would speak and for how long. The dispute was settled when King agreed to limit his remarks to 4 minutes and speak last. Leaders of other civil rights groups figured they had outmaneuvered King because TV cameramen would depart by mid-afternoon to prepare for their nightly broadcast. But to their surprise, the network cameras and the crowd waited to hear from King. He had been introduced by A. Philip Randolph as the moral leader of the nation. As King spoke in clipped, poetic phrases, shortened to meet the time limit put on his speech, the crowd began to repeat his catchphrases about freedom and dreams. Even on a stifling August afternoon, King's words soared. By this time, he had dropped his script and was improvising.
I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
All the threats of violence melted away with King's powerful words. He went over the four-minute limit, speaking for 16 minutes. Wade Henderson, who rode his bicycle to the march as a 15-year-old living in Washington, D.C., is now executive director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. Henderson says there's a clear connection between the march and critical congressional action that came in the next 2 years.
The 64 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act in rapid succession seem to have found in large measure their impetus from the March on Washington. And it was that phase of the civil rights movement that ultimately opened the door to the movements for equal rights for women, for Latinos and other racial and ethnic minorities, for persons with disabilities, for workers, for gays and lesbians.
Words from King's speech were recently carved into the steps of the Lincoln Memorial at the exact spot where King spoke. And the only speaker at the march who remains alive today, John Lewis, has now served almost 18 years as a Georgia congressman. The march that faced so much opposition is now viewed as a triumph by civil rights activists and the Washington establishment. Juan Williams, NPR News, Washington.
I'm writers and critics who prophesize with your pen.
You can hear extended interviews with organizers of the March on Washington at our website, npr.org. On Monday, Juan profiles some of the people who took part in that historic march on August 28, 1963.
That its naming was the loser, now will be later to win, for the times they are a change.